This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
His Excellency Mr. David Daly, Ambassador of the European Union to Australia, and his wife Adine, and Senator Ursula Stevens, Senator for New South Wales and Parliamentary Secretary for Inclusion and the Voluntary Sector, and Mazula Tunney, the Deputy Head of Mission at the Embassy of Ireland in Canberra. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to the launch of Sinners, Saints and Settlers. My name is Matthew Trinker and I'm the Assistant Director for Collections, Content and Exhibitions at the National Museum of Australia. Before we start proceedings, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the country in which we meet today, the Ngambri Ngunnawal people of the Canberra region, and also to welcome other Indigenous Australians who might be with us today. I should also tell you that this event is being recorded so that it might be available on the museum's website as an audio on-demand program. Well, this is a great day for the museum and for all the people who've been involved in the production of this book. It's the culmination of a great deal of work by our two collaborators, Richard Reed and Brendan Kelson, and also for the team at the NMA responsible for bringing it to press, especially Julie Simpkin, the editor, and Sarah Evans, the designer. Sinners, Saints and Settlers is part of a wide-ranging NMA project to document the long history of the Irish people in Australia. It's a project which will culminate next year in a major temporary exhibition on the Irish in Australia, to open, of course, on St Patrick's Day. And later, after the exhibition run here in Canberra, we intend to take the exhibition to Dublin, to our good friends at the National Museum of Ireland, and then on to Belfast. But this book is not the catalogue of the exhibition. It stands on its own, exploring Irish presence in this country as revealed through the study of 55 places across the continent. Now, in the book, you'll find stories of the Irish convict experience. You'll learn about the nature of general emigration from Ireland between 1788 and the present, key moments when Irish nationalism became an issue in Australia, moments like the discussion around Home Rule, the Young Irelanders in Tasmania, the 1798 memorial in Sydney, and, of course, Archbishop Mannix's support for Irish independence. There also are iconic stories, iconic Australian stories, Irish Australian stories, such as that of the Kelly Gang and the Eureka Rebellion. There's the contributions of the Irish born to general Australian social, economic and political development, the key role of the Irish in the Catholic Church in Australia, and the ways in which the Irish presence in this country still echoes today. All of this would not have been possible without the great support of the Embassy of Ireland in Canberra and Jim Murphy, both of whom have supported the project with financial contributions. And I'm particularly delighted that we're joined today by Ms. Orla Tunney of the Embassy of Ireland. Orla is the Deputy Head of Mission and responsible for political and economic affairs at the Embassy. And I'd now like to invite her to the podium to officially launch the volume.
Thank you, Matt. Good morning, everyone. It's always a pleasure to be at the National Museum of Australia. It's an institution that we're very fond of, and we prize our collaboration with the museum very much at the Embassy of Ireland. Today, of course, it's a particular pleasure to be here on the occasion of the launch of Sinners, Saints and Settlers. I'm honoured to be asked to launch this book and to represent Ireland here today. The Irish Constitution in Article 2 includes this line: "The Irish nation cherishes its special affinity with people of Irish ancestry living abroad who share its cultural identity and heritage." That's in Article 2 of our Constitution, so it's pretty high up there in terms of the basic foundations of what it means to be Irish and what we represent at the embassy. And we, in Australia, which is a major diaspora nation, it's a very important part of our work, reaching out to those of Irish heritage in Australia and working with them. Over the years, many hundreds of thousands of people left Ireland. Most of them would have probably preferred to have been able to stay, but sadly, for one reason or another, that wasn't possible for them. But after they left, they retained an affection for Ireland, which has been passed on through the generations and which is a unique asset for Ireland today. Irish migrants and their descendants became Australian, but they retained memories of Ireland and an affinity with many aspects of what we like to call the Irish character. Very many of their descendants have a love of Irish culture, and thank you to the musician today representing Irish culture in that very lively way for us, and an interest in Irish history. The support of the Irish diaspora has been vital to Ireland economically and politically. As you will read in the book we celebrate today, their active interest helped in Ireland's struggle for independence. More recently, the diaspora was also mobilised to support the successful peace process in Northern Ireland. We're proud of our global Irish family and its solidarity across the miles and down through the generations. This manifests itself in many ways, from the major economic conference for diaspora business leaders, which our Prime Minister held in Ireland last year, to collaborations such as this one that we have with the museum in celebrating the achievements and the growth of of Irish communities around the world. It's not surprising, therefore, that when the embassy was initially approached to support the publication of this book, that we reacted with great enthusiasm. I also want to acknowledge the other supporters of the book, including the National Australian Irish Business Association and in particular Mr. Jim Murphy. Now, Richard and Brendan may not be aware of this, but thanks to the Embassy's financial interest in the publication of the book, we do retain a copy of the original pitch on our file, and it is itself an interesting historical document. Looking back over it before this launch, I noticed a strong thread in that submission, which was that the book was to be a popular and accessible work aimed at a broad rather than an academic readership. Now, I'm not going to say anything against academics, particularly in this company, but I'd like to say that this aspect of the book's mission resonates very much with me, and this museum is a wonderful place to celebrate reaching out to the ordinary people of Australia, to new audiences, to people who aren't particularly interested in history, but who just have a general curiosity about their society and about what went into shaping it. I want to thank Richard Reid and Brendan Kelson for the very considerable work that they put into their mission, and each bringing his own strengths and experience to what is a wonderful book, which I commend to you all. And it brings a fresh view to many aspects of the history which binds us together as Irish and as Australians. I like the focus in the book on learning the stories behind public monuments. The theme of the familiar being re-examined and revealing a deeper significance is an exciting one which recurs throughout the book. And I expect and I hope that this theme will be developed further in the exhibition to open next year on the Irish in Australia, when Australians will be invited to discover how so many features of this great society came to be in existence here, and in particular how many of them were influenced by Irish thinking. Inviting people to see a new meaning behind the familiar is a worthwhile philosophical and cultural endeavour, and I commend this book for inviting us all to take a step along that path. Now, I'm not sure what the protocol is for launching a book. I understand I don't break a bottle of champagne on it, but in launching the book, I'd like to just open it and invite you all to read it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Orla, and for those kind, generous words. And also, thank you for the continued support that we have felt from the Embassy. The Ambassador, I know, has been a great supporter of these projects, Mochina Fannin, and I'd appreciate you conveying to him our deep thanks for the work that the Embassy is doing on behalf of this book and also the work to come. Thank you. Many of you, of course, will know Brendan Kelson, the co-author and photographer for Sinners, Saints and Settlers. Mr. Kelson is a former director of the Australian War Memorial and was closely involved in the development of the National Gallery of Australia. Could you now please welcome Mr. Brendan Kelson to the podium?
Good morning. Well, a long gestation, yes, but finally a good delivery. We had, of course, the assistance of three top Irish midwives, Ambassadors Richard O'Brien, Declan Kelly, and Martin O'Neill. So our thanks to them, the Government of the Republic of Ireland, and to our own Jim Murphy for encouragement and valued financial support. Richard and I have, in the book, expressed our appreciation to the many who have helped us along the way, to which I would like to add my thanks to the staff of the museum who brought the project to conclusion. The historical evidence of the Irish in Australia is all about us. Monuments and memorials, churches and cemeteries, fine estates and humble cottages, rural landscapes and ruins, around pubs, racecourses and football clubs, and in verse and song. Take the Bagot Handicap run at Flemington Racecourse every New Year's Day. Robert Cooper Bagot, civil engineer from County Kildare, first transformed the Melbourne Cricket Ground and then, more famously, Flemington Racecourse. He turned the evil-smelling centre marsh into the flat, made horse racing a sport for the ordinary citizen, and set the example and standard for racecourses right around Australia. And what about Australian public houses? I wonder how many haven't been run or owned by Irishmen or their descendants at one time or another. Think of the Shamrock, Harp, Killarney, Daniel O'Connell hotels dotted across the country. And there, opposite Flinders Street Station, sits Young and Jackson, Melbourne's famous watering hole, bought in 1875 by two Irish diggers, Henry Young and Thomas Jackson. Everyone knows of the Blarney Stone set in the Tower of Blarney Castle, County Cork, the kissing of which is supposed to endow one with sweet, persuasive, wheedling eloquence. But did you know there's a Blarney Stone in the village of Killarney in the Western District of Victoria? Some years ago, an enterprising young fellow thought he might turn the local hostelry into a sort of Bunratty Castle, pull in the tourists and make a quid or two. A first move was to acquire a large block of Port Fairy basalt, pop it along the highway, and declare it to be the Blarney Stone Killarney. Well, the venture never took off, but the stone remains. Tourist coaches continued to stop, and some passengers were even tempted to kiss the stone until a local resident felt obliged to say, "I wouldn't do that if I were you. A lot of long-legged dogs pass this way." When you think of shopping, David Jones and Meyer might come to mind, but the Ahern's, Lowe's and more have been there too. Mark Foy's, with its piazza, chandeliers, marble and sumptuous ballroom, was for most of the last century a Sydney institution and one of Australia's foremost fashion stores. And older Melburnians will remember well the stamp and style of the Buckley and Nunn Emporium in Bourke Street. David Jones it may be now, but the city's pun survives. You have two chances, Buckley's and none. Monuments and memorials are everywhere. Waverley Cemetery has perhaps the finest of all memorials to the United Irishmen's insurrection of 1798. At the top end of Swanston Street stands Sir Redmond Barry, remembered here not for sentencing Ned Kelly to be hanged, but as the founder of now the State Library of Victoria at the University of Melbourne. At the other end of town are the Melbourne tragic figures of Burke and Wills. On North Terrace, suffragist Mary Lee has her gaze fixed on the stronghold of South Australian conservatism, the Adelaide Club. C.Y. O'Connor reflects on Fremantle Harbour, the first of his two great engineering feats, the second being the water pipeline to Kalgoorlie. For heroes, look no further than the graves of Martin O'Meara, Victoria Cross, and Father John Fay, Distinguished Service Order, in Perth's Karrakatta Cemetery. The Irish in Australia have achieved much in sport. The next time you pass through Maitland, you might pause to take a look at the bronze figure of Les Darcy, once the golden boy of Australian boxing, tragically dead at 21. The list goes on. And if you're out towards Gulgong, New South Wales, 11 kilometres down the road to the southeast, there is a sign which reads simply, Home Rule. Nothing beside remains to tell you of the hopes and aspirations of a number of Irish gold prospectors who worked and passed this way in the early 1870s. In the first 50 years of Federation, Australia had six Irish-Australian Prime Ministers. You might consider, among other things, how much this country has changed by taking a glance at how two of them lived to the ends of their days. John Curtin's bungalow sits in a quiet street in Cottesloe, Western Australia, and Ben Chifley's cottage is a short step from the railway yards in Bathurst, New South Wales. A strong Irish thread runs through our literature, language, and our larrikin tradition, with some here, I am sure, remembering 1960s Melbourne, when Tram 16 travellers on Glenferrie Road might have read a question on the billboard outside the Hawthorne Church of Christ. What would you do if Jesus came to Hawthorne? And the scrawled answer below it, move Peter Hudson to centre half forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Brendan, for those words and also for your long labours on this project, which has resulted in such a fine volume. Thank you very much. Our last speaker is Dr. Richard Reid, co-author of the book and the senior curator leading development of the Irish in Australia exhibition. Dr. Reid is a well-known and respected public historian, a former high school teacher of history and English, and museum education officer. He also leads historical tours to Ireland and the Western Front and Gallipoli battlefields. Please welcome Dr. Reid to the podium.
Well, thank you, Matt. Most of the thank yous have been said, so I'm not going to go over them again. They come from me as much as from Brendan. But I would like to just acknowledge the presence of my wife, who's here today, and thank her for her forbearance over the years on, as she says, an endless number of projects. And it doesn't seem to be going to stop. Look, I thought we were going to be upstaged here this morning. I thought that the Independents on the Hill would be making their announcement and that that would be it. There'd be no Canberra Times photographer and et cetera, et cetera. But I'm pleased to say that might happen this afternoon for Dr. Peter Stanley's launch, so they might all be over there for that. It reminded me that around 1898 or 99, and I've forgotten the exact year, that the Irish upstaged the Australian Constitution in its final drafting. Robert Garran was in the Windsor Hotel in Melbourne, along with Robert Kingston and Toby Pisspot Barton. Isn't that a wonderful description of him? Apparently he enjoyed the odd wine. And anyway, these gentlemen went to bed progressively through the night as the final draft was being done, leaving Garran alone to send the draft out to be printed for the coming day's discussion in the Assembly on these matters. And as he left the hotel that morning, I don't know if you know the Windsor Hotel in Melbourne, it's very close to the Parliament House in Melbourne, and he looked up the road and he saw this crowd gathering. And he thought, they have come to congratulate us on our labours on finally finishing the Australian Constitution. But as he approached and got closer, he discovered there were actually Irishmen gathering to celebrate St. Patrick's Day March that day. So I have never forgotten that particular image in my mind of that. The other thing, I was very pleased that Matt acknowledged country here this morning, the Indigenous people of this land. We could perhaps acknowledge another Irish association with this very site, which I uncovered in the Mitchell Library on my labours for the exhibition. And that was a lovely little program, in fact, two or three of them, for the St. Patrick's Day races that used to be held here at Acton. And actually, the museum occupies a little bit of that particular ground. So I was pleased to come across that. So I acknowledge those who used to go to the St. Patrick's Day races here in Canberra in the 1930s. Look, I labored long and hard in thinking, what does an author say about something that he's finished, that you've done? What can you say about a book that you've written? It's pretty hard. A lot of it can just be kind of egotistical babblings about things. But I thought I'd try and share with you a few of the pictures that I got in my mind when writing this book. I have a little quote that I want to read you from a gentleman called Henry Glassie, who I'm sure you've never heard of. He's an ethnographic historian based in Boston, and he spent a great many years, nearly as many years as we took to write this book, 10 years, studying a little tiny piece of a parish in County Fermanagh in Ireland, a little place called Ballymanone. And he looked at this in incredible detail, but he came up with this quote about history, and I've always liked it, and I thought, this is what I've been trying to do in this book. History is not the past, but a map of the past, drawn from a particular point of view to be useful to the modern traveller. So that's what this book seems to me to be trying to do from my point of view. If you were travelling around and looking at various things in Australia, what could I say to you if I can hold you for 5 minutes or 10 minutes? And that's my experience, by the way, as a tour guide or as an education officer. 10 minutes is probably what you've got anywhere to say something to somebody. And I'll quite make sure I don't go on for more than 10 minutes. But anyway, let me just share with you a few of these places and the kind of things that emerge from them. Now, if you were to visit the suburb of Box Hill in Melbourne, I don't know how many of you have ever been to Box Hill, it's a very significant suburb in Melbourne, and go to the Uniting Church there, you would see a beautiful Willis pipe organ. And you would look at it, on one side it's got Jesus is love written up on the wall, on the other side God is Lord, or something phrases of that nature. And you might think, well, here on Sundays people gather to praise God, to say their prayers and everything else. It would come as a considerable shock to you to realize this organ once stood in the ballroom of an Irishman called Henry Money Miller. Now, I have to confess in advance that I'm very sorry that this Irishman was a Presbyterian and not a Roman Catholic. It would have suited my purposes much better if he'd been Catholic, and you'll see why. This organ originally stood in his ballroom at Findon in Kew. Miller was known to be the greatest miser of his generation in Melbourne, giving nothing to charity whatsoever. And he was visited in 1888, the celebration, if you like, of the first 100 years of European Australia, by a wonderful character called George Myrtle. And Myrtle wrote this book called Memoirs of a Spendthrift. But he was called to see Henry Murray Miller in his dying years, and he found him in the billiard room, quite close to where the ballroom was, counting coins. In fact, he was counting something called Jimmy Goblins. And Jimmy Goblin, I looked up this morning, is a British slang word for gold sovereigns. And this is how he describes this elderly Irish miser. We don't think of them as like that, do we? We think of them as quite different. But here he is. What a lovely dotage to be in. Just to do nothing but sit all day playing with new Jimmy Goblins. To absorb their glitter and hearken to their click and clink. To spend a long life gathering money, piling it up, seeing it grow without spending more than keeps one alive, indulging one's ruling passion to the utmost, right to the door of death. What a brilliant picture of an Irishman in Australia that sums up another aspect of the Irish presence. It's wonderful. Another comment made about Miller was that his counting house is his church, his ledger is his Bible, and money is his God. How appropriate that the organ from his ballroom has ended up in the Uniting Church in Box Hill. That's what I say. So if you're there and you happen to be passing through Box Hill, stop and take a look at this beautiful pipe organ. By the way, Matt, could we get that for the exhibition? You know, let's wrench it out of the of its surrounding. Another image of an Irishman, very, very different, and one that you will all, a gentleman who you will all know, of course, is Daniel Mannix. Now, if you go to Melbourne, there's a statue of Daniel Mannix outside St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne. And you might have thought that that has been there forever. Actually, originally, there used to be a statue there of Daniel O'Connell, the great liberator of Ireland, the emancipator, and so on. That was taken down, I think, by Archbishop Hart, taken out, laid on its back, and forgotten about, until suddenly Mary McAleese, the president of Ireland, was visiting. And George Pell, who was at that stage Archbishop, said, "Where the hell's O'Connell?" And sent his assistant priest off to find O'Connell, who came back. He's lying on his back, Archbishop, you know, out there in this storage bed. Get him up, you know, quickly. Mary McAleese is coming. So consequently, O'Connell is re-erected at the back of the cathedral. I was told that story by this priest who knew all about this. But anyway, it's not O'Connell there anymore. It's Daniel Mannix. Now, I'm sure that Daniel Mannix has been placed there because he is regarded by Melbourne Catholics as one of the great Catholic leaders of Melbourne. But, of course, there's another side to Mannix completely, and that is the side which is the great supporter of Irish independence. And there are a couple of beautiful stories about that relating to Mannix. If you look close by, you will see another little plaque there at St. Patrick's Cathedral, which says that the cross on the top of the main spire was donated to the cathedral by the Government of Ireland in 1938. And you might think, what largesse? You know, the Government of Ireland was going around the world looking for cathedrals, you know, to give spires, or not spires, to give Celtic crosses to celebrate the connection between the people of Ireland and these various places. There's only one reason that cross is there, and that was because Daniel Mannix at the time was Archbishop, and the man who headed the government in Ireland was De Valera. And of course, De Valera and Mannix were thick as thieves as regards the independence of Ireland. And the best image I can give you of that is one when Daniel Mannix in 1920 tried to go back to Ireland to visit ostensibly his aged mother, but also because he was going to obviously say a few things about the independence of Ireland during a time when the War of Independence was going on. He wasn't allowed to go. His liner, the Baltic, was intercepted on the high seas. I'm not quite sure on the high seas or inside British territorial waters. It's a moot point, and I'm not quite sure about that. By the Wyvern, HMAS Wyvern, a British destroyer. And the Archbishop and his secretary, Father Vaughan, were taken off the liner and put ashore in England at Penzance. But the image I want to give you of that is that Mannix was told by these two British detectives who got on board that he wasn't going to be allowed to land in Britain, that there was a destroyer there waiting to take him to England, after which he could do pretty much as he wished, but he wasn't allowed to go to Ireland. The Archbishop packed up his case, and he stood quietly at the top of the gangway, not moving. And the British detective spotted exactly what he was about and placed his hand quietly on Mannix's shoulder so as the Archbishop could say, I was arrested on the high seas. I wasn't just taken off. It was a full official arrest. When they got to Penzance, by the way, I thought a lovely thing there was the parish priest wasn't in. And so Father Vaughan described this. I, Vaughan, took my courage in both hands and told her we were both starving. These are some nuns that they found in the presbytery. So these French nuns befriended them. Neither of us could eat in the confined cabin of the Wyvern. His Grace was delighted to get to the convent away from the crowd. The sisters were most kind. We enjoyed their cups of tea immensely. So I love thinking of Mannix getting off at Penzance having a cup of tea. I wonder if the teacups exist. Yeah, that would be a real thing to bring in, an iconic piece to bring in. But there's Mannix. As you outside the cathedral, you think it's something about Catholicism, but it's about a lot more when you think of it. And I want to finish on one last and rather sadder story. And perhaps it's my, I can't call my favourite in the book, but certainly one that I think is perhaps the most moving. In 1872, the English writer Anthony Trollope came out to Australia and travelled around and eventually produced a travel book on all this. And he went to Port Arthur in Tasmania. And I'm sure an awful lot of you have been to that marvellous convict site. It contains one of the grimmest reminders of the convict experience in Australia, the silent prison, where men had to wear masks when they came out of their cells and were to sit in their cells all day ruminating on their crimes and their guilt and so on. And if they came out, they couldn't speak to each other. And he met there an Irishman. Who else? A gentleman that he described as one-eyed Dennis Doherty. Now, Doherty had been transported in 1833 to Australia for mutiny, and there he was, still in 1872, a prisoner of the Crown. It's interesting that right beside this silent prison where Doherty was for many, many years, you can sip your lattes and cappuccinos and think, all right, about the convict experience. But anyway, he met Doherty, and Doherty informed him that he had never been a free man for an hour since 1833, and that during that time he had received upwards of 3,000 lashes. 3,000. And his actual convict record illustrates that he's not far off the mark for that. Trollope felt that he had to show Doherty some kindness, because Doherty said that he needed some mercy in his old age. He was a dying man and finished. And he said to Trollope, I have tried to escape, always to escape as a bird does out of a cage. Is this unnatural? Is this a great crime? And the prison warders told Trollope, look, if you take Doherty away, his hand is against every man, he'd as soon put a knife in you as look at you, and so on and so forth. But there's this other very different kind of experience. So that's what I think I'm trying to capture in this book. As you stand at these places, you get a sense of who these people are. And you get a sense, if you go across the 55 places, that each of them represents something symbolic in the history of the Irish in Australia. You can get that, of course, from Patrick O'Farrell's marvellous book on the Irish in Australia, but you can also get it by going to places and thinking a little bit about the stories that unfold there if you would only listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. And I think you'll agree with me that it's as though Richard was made to write this book and to lead this exhibition. What he doesn't know about the Irish in Australia, I can honestly say, is not worth knowing. And the museum counts itself entirely lucky and fortunate to have him to lead this program through these years. Thank you once again to everyone that's been involved in the production of this fine book. I also want to thank our performer, Miss Jacqueline Bradley, who was supplying the music before and we hope after the formal proceedings. That's the end of the speech making. Can I now just indulge in a shameless plug and tell you that the book is on sale at the museum shop at the bargain basement price of $39.95. Only today, is that true? Or is it $39.95 every day? No matter. This is the day to buy it. And if you're lucky, you'll be able to catch Richard Reed and Brendan Kelson to sign your copy as well. Please stay with us for the refreshments and to enjoy the music, and I thank you all for attending today. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.